This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's time once again to check in with the Indiana veteran economist, writer, and public speaker Morton Marcus on some of the topics he brings up in his regular columns across the Hoosier State. And we have a chance to talk about economic development and other similar topics here on Regionally Speaking when we bring him on. Morton, thanks for being with us today.
Greetings from Pineville, Kentucky.
Well, thank you very much for that. I hope you say you're traveling through the mountains. So let's hope that you make it through the mountains okay, and we'll pick up some of the topics here that I'd like to bring to light here from the recent Eye on the Pie columns that you have out. One of the latest columns you talk about is an interesting point, although this is in Northeast Indiana. It could happen in Northwest Indiana, I suppose, where you've got a couple businesses that are kind of shifting cities, so to speak. But one of the things you bring up in the column is the fact that for some reason, a state economic development funding's gotten involved in this location transaction, and maybe it wasn't quite the place to use that money. Tell us about the two cities, the businesses involved, and why the questions you raised about the Indiana Economic Development Corporation.
Well, this is a case where a furniture company that was located in Grable, Indiana, which is just northeast of Fort Wayne, is moving to New Haven, Indiana, which is in the same county, Allen County. It's just a little bit east of Fort Wayne. The total distance is about 12 miles. And the state is offering something in the neighborhood of $360,000 in assistance to this company for the move. Now, if you can imagine a company that's in Hammond deciding to move to Munster, or a company that's in Griffith deciding to move to Crown Point, why should the state get involved with that kind of move? Why, in fact, should even the local governments be involved? We have just too much of this business of providing subsidies for any kind of movement of a firm. Everybody's so eager to get that future tax base. But does the county as a whole gain anything? Maybe, yes. Sometimes the move involves an expansion. They say they're going to add about 60 jobs in Allen County, and that's all very good. But it seems to me that this is a typical beggar-thy-neighbor kind of situation. And I would think that in Lake County and Porter County, the localities should get together and say, we're not going to do this. And the state should not get involved in a movement that doesn't bring something new to the state. Just moving it from one part of the state to another is not sufficient. There should be a real big change in the capability of the company to produce. So that's what that column's all about.
Well, it'd be interesting to see what happens if any pressure is put on the Indiana Economic Development Corporation to take a second look when they have these cases come up like this and kind of sit back and take a look and decide, well, maybe we shouldn't send any money their way just yet. Maybe they'll need some help for something else in particular, more specific, and I guess you could leave it open to that. But for now, at least, you know, don't jump ahead and just try and bring them, just give them a bunch of money in the hopes that they'll relocate or locate some jobs in to be sure. One of the other...
There's no indication that this company was going to move out of Allen County. They say that they're very pleased with the workforce they have. All they wanted was a little more coordination of their activities. And I can understand the desire to have better facilities, but I don't see this as the kind of thing that taxpayer money should be spent on.
Mm-hmm. One of the other columnists you had recently here talks about President Donald Trump and how he seems to be taking action with his ideas in trimming back the federal budget that's going to make some tough decisions that have to be made on the local and state levels. Tell us about that, please.
Well, very clearly, the notions that the president put into his budget are going to really hit locally. You just think of the Lake County Public Library. I don't know how much money they get through the library services portion the federal government. You think of your radio station probably gets some federal funds also.
Oh yes, we get quite a bit of support. But you know, for looking at the whole budget, for our whole budget,
right.
We get a decent chunk from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Well, yeah. That becomes very significant at the local level, and people ought to be asking themselves whether or not they're willing. The people of Lake and Porter counties, and your signal actually reaches down into Jasper and Newton counties, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
They ought to be asking whether they want to cut back at the federal level and increase the amount of money they give at the local level. Well, you know how difficult it is to raise money for public radio and for public television all the time, and this federal grant makes it possible for people all over the United States to have the kind of quality programming that that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting enables. I think that we've got to ask ourselves what should the federal government be supporting, and the president is forcing these kinds of decisions. I think that in a way it's a very healthy thing for us to ask these questions. Maybe we've been taking things too much for granted, that the federal government will always be there to help out, and maybe we should have higher levels of listener support for our local stations. But that's the kind of thing that is being forced upon us right now. To make those decisions.
I know also in the column you mentioned too about the fact that in his proposed budget that the president wants to eliminate funding for the Legal Services Corporation, and about 12% of the budget for the Indiana Legal Services comes from federal funds. And how ironically it comes at a time when Indiana Legal Services is about to celebrate 50th anniversary.
Exactly, and they have let me know that my 12% figure is a mistake.
Oh, really?
It's actually 65%.
Oh my goodness! Yes, yes, that's.
Yes. I got the wrong data out of their annual report, and I was pleased to have them correct that, and I'm glad that I have a chance here on the radio to correct that as well. It's 65% of legal aid. Now, this is aid that goes strictly to help poor people who have legal problems.
People That's right.
who may be evicted, people who may be involved in domestic violence, all kinds of different civil cases, not criminal cases, but civil cases, where the poor just can't get the kind of representation that a wealthier person could get. And it's, again, a national program. And do we want to have a situation where the people of Lake County and the people of Porter and Jasper and Newton and the Port counties have to come up with the money to see to it that there's adequate representation, legal representation in these cases? Or are we willing to say this is a national responsibility and the federal government should be involved? We may not like the idea that the president is making these suggestions, but he is forcing us to face the reality of the situation.
In fact, we'll have some comments here from somebody who has helped out folks in East Chicago here with the problems that residents have had in that area, and his concerns about how his own particular agency is going to be affected by any big cuts in the
right.
in the budget he faces from the Trump administration. We're going to have that feature coming up here shortly. Indiana economist and writer and public speaker Morton Marcus. The threats by the Trump administration to make serious cuts in the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development budget will, in the opinion of a regional public housing executive, caused some rather disastrous results. Richard Minocchio runs the Cook County Housing Authority, which has offered help for East Chicago residents through its counterpart, the East Chicago Housing Authority, in finding new residences for the West Calumet District residents. And Richard didn't mince any words when the subject of the HUD budget came up recently.
Things that we're doing now that are special things, you know, to make, for example, having funding to rehabilitate units quickly to deal with an emergency situation would, you know, that if this budget passes, or if any form of this budget passes, that those days are over. It would be virtually impossible for housing authorities like ours and others to to make units that need to be rehabilitated, or units where a family may have lived there for 10 years, for example, and then moved on, to turn those units over in a quick fashion to move somebody else in. So on top of that, if this any part of this budget passes, there's going to be far fewer vouchers, most likely, for families that not only this, you know, the families that we house today, but anybody who's been waiting for housing for years and years and years that qualifies, it won't be won't qualify. So yeah, I would say without question, this budget would have this budget were in place, this kind of program that we're doing right now with East Chicago would not have been possible.
Now, do you think that in your standing as the head of the second largest housing authority in the state of Illinois, that you have maybe if not some clout, you have certainly some influence that you hope that you can pass along to the folks with the department in Washington?
I spent on Capitol Hill talking to most members of the Illinois delegation, both on both sides of the aisle, to stress to them how critical that these safety net programs are. You know, it's we're talking about, you know, working poor folks. I mean, the majority of our people work in lower paying jobs, and it's you know, the bottom line is a human crisis. Just like crises we see all over the world today, the lack of affordable housing in the United States is a human crisis. And if this draconian budget were to take effect, the consequences of that would reverberate like nothing we've ever seen before. So as you can kind of tell, I don't sugarcoat, and I was pretty clear with our members that this would be the case. I haven't had the chance to speak with Dr. Carson yet. I understand that he's on a listening tour around the country, but we did invite him. We did invite him here to see what we're doing, and it's you know, I don't need to your listeners understand that this is an ill-conceived, mean-spirited, nonsensical budget.
That's Cook County Housing Authority Executive Director Richard Minacchio. The Washington Post reports that even though the Trump administration proposal could maintain funding levels for subsidized housing programs, local housing authorities might be forced to have to scale back the number of housing vouchers that are available because of inflation and the rising housing costs. That could mean a loss of up to 200,000 subsidized housing vouchers in the country in the years ahead. A gold coin donated to a Northwest Indiana church is so rare that it's helping pay for the construction of a new church building. Lakeshore Public Radio's Dan Clark tells us about it.
Pastor Ben Lamb says Grace Point Church was founded in 2009 with a bare-bones budget and operated out of an elementary school. As the church grew, the congregation came together and raised enough money to purchase a building. However, with general maintenance and renovations figured into the cost, the church was still short $300,000. Soon after this revelation, Lamb says a woman who's a member of Grace Point Church in Valparaiso said to him,
"I think I've got a coin that might be able to help."
At first, Lamb says he wasn't aware of how valuable the $20 gold piece coin was until he contacted a few auction houses.
That's when we knew we had something. And so we just did a lot of research. Our team made a lot of phone calls, and man, the rest is history. It's crazy.
Sarah Miller of Heritage Auctions says the $20 gold piece is one of only 10 known surviving 1866 Liberty Head double eagles, stamped with "In God We Trust." It could fetch more than $300,000 when it sold at auction April 27th. Pastor Ben Lamb says Heritage Auctions wired the church $150,000 for advance payment toward the coin's final auction price, and that's allowed construction to begin already on the new building. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Dan Clark.
At the State House, House and Senate authors of vaping regulation legislation say they are in 99% agreement on the bill as the session draws to a near end by the end of the week. Indiana Public Broadcasting's State House reporter, Brandon Smith, tells us about the remaining issues that lawmakers are grappling with in that particular measure.
There's general agreement in the e-liquid bill about rules that include reporting ingredients to state regulators and certain labeling and barcode requirements. Logansport Republican Senator Randy Head says a provision still to be decided involves so-called open and closed e-liquid systems. Open vaping systems are refillable. Closed systems are sealed, meant for one-time use. At issue, Head says, is whether regulations should apply equally to both.
Logically, it seems to most people, I think, that the rules ought to apply evenly to everyone, but the people who make closed systems are presenting their case.
Bern Republican Representative Matt Lehman says the other unresolved issue is whether to allow online sales. Lehman says he's not certain about the effectiveness of online age verification technology.
Until more of that gets developed over time, that I think a face-to-face is probably the better path.
The legislature hopes to end its 2017 session this week. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Muncie hopes to be the next Hoosier City with its own cat cafe near Ball State University. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brittany M. Ehrman reports, the man who's behind the local spot called the Two Cats Cafe plans to open an addition next to or to it in August where you can wine and dine with the feline and then adopt it.
Oh my gosh, you are so cute.
Two Cats Cafe is raising money to open a cat cafe called Zenden, a catmosphere that will allow customers to bring their food from the cafe and enjoy it with a potential pet. Cafe owner Bassam Hawani says the theme will be similar to the Two Cats Cafe.
People come here and they feel, you know, comfortable. They come here and do their homework, have good bites to eat.
Even though the cats will be in the cafe, they will still be available for adoption. The cats will come from the Animal Rescue Fund to help fix a bigger issue in the Muncie community. Executive Director Jody Letty says shelters are only allowed to take so many cats to maintain a clean environment. The cats that aren't in the shelters end up on the streets of Muncie.
We're hoping that this will provide a quicker turnover, so to speak, as far as getting more cats adopted out more quickly.
In a hope to lower the overpopulation of cats and help them find a forever home. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brittany Ehrman in Muncie.
Governor Eric Holcomb will soon find out which three candidates he'll choose from to replace the retiring Supreme Court Justice and Gary native Robert Rucker. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith tells us about the Judicial Nominating Commission's final selection process.
Indiana's Judicial Nominating Commission is made up of the Chief Justice, three members chosen by the governor, and three lawyers elected by other lawyers. When a judicial vacancy comes up on the state Supreme Court, the commission winnows a field of candidates down to three for the governor to pick from. This week, the commission will interview 11 semifinalists to replace retiring Justice Robert Rucker. Those candidates were selected from a larger field after a round of interviews back in March. IU McKinney School of Law professor Joel Shum says the commission's questions will be more difficult this round.
Between the first interview and the second interview, the commission members will have called references, spoken to other lawyers, and done sort of some background work to get a better feel for the candidates.
And Shum says he expects the final candidates to be politically middle of the road.
Someone who's very ideological or polarizing is not generally going to do well in the process.
The three finalists will be chosen Wednesday. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
The Hobart-based Luke family of brands is solidly behind the expansion of Tim Hortons here in Indiana. Luke will be developing some new stores for the Canadian chain in Lafayette and Indianapolis. IndyChannel.com is reporting that construction on the Far West Side Indianapolis store could begin next month. Tim Hortons specializes in coffee and other specialty drinks, fruit smoothies, baked goods, grilled and classic sandwiches, wraps, and prepared soups. It first opened in the United States in 1984. It's very popular in Canada, and it's located elsewhere in the Midwest. Stores right now of Tim Hortons located around Fort Wayne and in Richmond. Every year, police departments at various levels in the region accumulate crime statistics. Different areas experienced rises and falls among the categories like homicides, shootings, property crime, and the like. Northwest Indiana's more urban zones, in particular, Gary, East Chicago, and Hammond, see high amounts of crime. It's prompted efforts to decrease these levels, which have seen some success with technology and programs. In the city of Gary, the efforts are twofold. Manifesting an investigative work by the Lake County and Gary Metro Homicide Unit and the anti-crime initiative called Gary for Life. Started in 2014 by Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson and operated by the city's police department, the initiative is concentrating its resources on reforming Gary's gang members and try to make the Steel City safe again. And it's the subject of this byline report from the Times of Northwest Indiana. Here's producer Cale Wilk.
From the Times of Northwest Indiana and nwi.com/podcasts, you're listening to Byline, the podcast about the newspaper's most fascinating stories and the reporters who tell them. I'm Cale Wilk, and this week Byline examines how Gary is trying to reshape its image. We'll talk with reporters constantly writing on crime in the region.
I mean, it's just you have to really be able to multitask, I guess, because you have to be constantly paying attention.
As well as a woman wanting to see her city change.
We are just like everyone else. That they feel just as safe in their community as any other community. So that is honestly my absolute hope, is that our children and our residents feel the exact same safety.
Gary, Indiana.
What a wonderful name.
Named for Albert Gary of judiciary fame. Gary, Indiana, as a Shakespeare would say, drips along softly on the tongue this way. Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana. Let me say it once again.
Perhaps this bit here sounds familiar, but it's Robert Preston as Harold Hill singing Gary, Indiana from the classic 1960s movie The Music Man. He speaks highly of the city in the song. But Harold Hill's concept of the city might have been different than it is today. It's kind of quiet. This is some audio from just standing in the main downtown portion of Gary on a block of Broadway Avenue in between 4th and 5th Avenues. Around there, there's City Hall, Lake County Superior Court, the Genesis Convention Center, the Gary South Shore Railcats Baseball Stadium, and the looming behemoth that is U.S. Steel Gary Works. There's almost not a soul walking around, just the cars passing by on these main avenues. It's not like this is new. But it's something people have wanted to change for a long time. And that's what we're going to touch on in this episode. But first we're going to sidestep to this week's reporters for a bit. And they are...
Sarah Reese, staff writer for The Times.
Lauren Cross, breaking news reporter on the night shift at The Times.
Yes, that's right. The dynamic duo of Sarah Reese and Lauren Cross have once again been brought back in for Byline. And for once, it's not about the Chicago leg crisis. Today, it looks at the function that takes up most of their time, covering crime and breaking news.
Hey, Lieutenant Hoyta, this is Lauren Cross from The Times. We received a tip tonight about a serious possible fatal accident at Michigan Street and in the hand. If you could, give me
this is some older audio that's been featured on Byline before of Lauren doing just that. Typically during the week, Sarah is in the newsroom at 6 a.m., reading releases and following up on reports from that day, or the previous ones to write up the various crime and breaking news bits that happen around the region. And then in the afternoon, at about 2 p.m., the baton gets handed off to Lauren, or whoever else might be the night reporter that day, who does much of the same. Should a major event happen, they'll go out to the scene to report on it. It's a vital and classic function of the newspaper to do this job.
I mean, it's just you have to really be able to multitask, I guess, because you have to be constantly paying attention to things that are happening, you know, on the scanner, following up on things. In the morning, I spend a lot of time going through lists of calls for service from different departments, you know, creating lists of case numbers that I want to request more information about. Trying to follow up on anything that maybe came in last night, but we couldn't contact any police officials to confirm things.
I think it's a really close working relationship with Sarah. She's been here 10 years. I've been here a little under 1 year. You know, so we just are really communicating throughout the day of what's going on, you know, even before I'm heading into work, because you always want to know what you're going into.
But occasionally the two do a larger piece. Recently, they did just that. At the beginning of the year, the various police departments gathered and released annual crime statistics. Sarah and Lauren, being the great number crunchers they are, accumulated that info and put it together in a story, as well as some charts.
Yeah, it takes a lot of work, actually, to get these stories together, because so in order to get the most recent statistics, you need to ask each individual department. And so they all start getting it ready after the first of the year, but they often don't have it done right away. I think the only department that had it to us on day one this year was Hammond. So we have to go through this process of asking each individual agency. I think there may have been more than 15 or 20 that we asked for data this year. And then we have to, you know, enter it all into our spreadsheets and make graphics and kind of think about it, and then do interviews on top of that. So it just takes some time to get it all together.
The story itself can be found at NWI.com. But some interesting bits worth noting include that, overall, even though some southern region municipalities like Crown Point, Hobart, and Valparaiso saw increases in violent crime from 2015 to 2016, their totals were lower than 10 years ago. East Chicago and Gary saw decreases in their violent crime. Places like Hammond, Munster, Schererville, Michigan City, and LaPorte saw increases in violent crime both over a 1 year and 10 year period. But officials say those increases are from small changes, not to be too concerned about. Sarah also wrote another story that took a deeper look into what departments in Northern Lake County, particularly in Hammond, East Chicago, and Gary, are doing to combat violent crimes like homicides and shootings. She notes that homicides are for the most part down. Hammond had 8, up from 1 in 2015, but less than the 10 from 2014. East Chicago had 6, which has decreased over time from as many as 13 in 2011. And Gary saw 46, down from 50 in 2015. Shootings are another thing. East Chicago shootings decreased from 51 in 2015 to 40 last year. And Gary's shootings, in which at least one person was wounded, also decreased, going from 126 in 2015 to 118 last year. In these stories by Sarah and Lauren, the particular attention being given to Gary is noted. In the middle of 2015, the Lake County Gary Metro Homicide Unit was formed. It concentrates resources toward homicides in Lake County. Gary had 46 of Lake County's 71 homicides last year. So the unit devotes more attention and resources to the homicide cases and investigations, especially the first 48 hours, helping them close 13 cases last year. We try to find out a bit more information from Officer Matthew Eaton of the Lake County Sheriff's Department, who oversees this unit, but he couldn't be reached for comment for this episode. The particular homicide unit, though, is working with another group, and it's called Gary for Life.
It's more of an initiative. Okay. We try to steer away from saying program because programs have a beginning and an ending. This is something that we are doing that we're trying to truly change a culture in the city, so it's more than just a program.
That's Joy Holiday, and she's the coordinator of Gary for Life. The initiative was started in 2014 by Gary's mayor, Karen Freeman Wilson. Joy took the place of a former coordinator for the initiative. It's modeled after NOLA for Life, which is in New Orleans, Louisiana. The initiative tries to reduce the gun violence in Gary, but it's not performed in a way of necessarily showing force. It's done in a peaceful, civil way. The idea being that crimes in a community are happening from a small percentage of people, particularly in Gary with gangs or, as Joy likes to refer to them, groups. So those that have identified or are affiliated with these groups and are on parole are compelled to come to a call-in meeting in which they are greeted by a number of city and community leaders. Even the mayor herself is often present. And it's a moment of intervention.
And this meeting is to deliver a message to them, basically. And in this message is that we'll stop you if you make us, but we'll help you if you let us. So in doing that, we're offering them a two-pronged message. And we have different community members that are there. We have faith leaders that are there. We have individuals that are just there and concerned about their community. And we are all standing as one to say that the level of violence and the level of gun violence that we have in our community is no longer accepted. However, just as we focus in on that message, the mayor is just as committed to what can we do to help you? What can we do to assist you in order to make this an easier transition for you? So it's not that, you know, it's a come to Jesus moment, yes. So after you hear from everyone, then you also hear from the community in. So you hear someone that's what we consider the moral voice of the community. And oftentimes as a faith leader in the community, basically giving them hope to say that you do have options. This is not the only option that you have to live your life in the manner in which you're living.
It's a caring moment where group members are saying, we know who you are and what you're affiliated with, and you don't have to be about that life. And they're offered social services to help too.
And then literally I'm able to see a change. But as they enter in the room, their defenses are up. And even as law enforcement, they're delivering their message, their defenses are still up. And I see a change in the room. So they've heard from, you know, someone giving them hope. They've heard from Goodwill saying, okay, well, these are the services that we have. I literally do not see a change in them until they hear a mother
come to the front of the room and start to tell them what happens at the end of that gun. And literally everything falls apart on them. Now they start to hear, now they start to listen, now they get a chance to experience what some of the decisions that they're making, what actually happens, how a family is affected by the choices in which they make. And so we're really trying to hone in on this message to give them, you know, a roadmap to a different decision to making sure that they're able to turn their lives around and essentially making our community safer.
The person leading the boots on the ground efforts, so to speak, is Corporal Doug Drummond of the Gary Police Department.
When we have our call-ins, I prepare the PowerPoint presentation. I hand select the participants that are going to be coming to our call-ins by working with probation, parole, and the Kimbrough Center. And that's pretty much day-to-day. Since January, I moved into the new slot, which is the operational lead, formerly held by Lieutenant Jack Hamady, who is now the commander of investigations. As the operational lead, I'm responsible for setting up our team meetings, which we have biweekly. Basically, the day-to-day operations of coordinating all of our MAG unit efforts with everything else that we're doing with the strategic focus.
Doug and others are also the ones identifying the group members in Gary through intelligence. Lauren noted in her article names that include the Glen Park Affiliated, Get Fresh Boys, the Fifth Avenue Boys, and more. Even on his end, they're implementing a caring strategy too.
One of the main things that we do is whenever we have a shooting or even a homicide, the first thing we want to do is we want to reach out to the victim or their family, close family members, associates, and we go out into the community, we speak with them, and basically we bring them a message. And the message that we bring them is that the violence in our community will not be tolerated any longer. And that, certain times, some of these individuals just don't even realize that shooting and retaliation to things like this are just not acceptable forms of behavior. So we'd much rather have contributing members of our society than locking people up. We realized a long time ago, we can't arrest our way out of the violence that goes on nationwide. I mean, this isn't just Gary, this is all over. We've seen rises in shootings all over the country, and we just want individuals to know that the community cares about them, we care about them. We do all this because we really do care. It's not just a program that we're bringing in and it'll be gone in a year or two or the next administration. This really is a strategy that's going to be the way of policing moving forward, trying to prevent the violence.
Like Doug noted, those with Gary for Life want to have productive members of their community. In these call-ins, group members are given options. They've been told the police know what they are or have been doing. They can come forward and provide information to stop these groups and violence, or if they choose not to, they are informed the police do have their eyes on them and will be concentrating resources on that group.
One of the messages is that, and I think it was shared in an article as well, you know, if that group is responsible for the next homicide or either has been deemed the most violent group in Gary, then that is when they have drawn all the attention of all of our law enforcement partners to that group or to that individual. So those are the choices that you're making. If you choose to do what it is that we're asking you to stop doing, which is committing this violence, then unfortunately, yes, you are going to have the attention of everyone that is behind us, that is one of our federal partners, as well as our local partners here. That is a choice that you have made. You have now self-selected yourself.
As Joy and Doug have both noted, these options are saying violence is not to be tolerated in Gary. It's a vision for the future of the city. We're not able to feature audio of these call-in meetings as Gary for Life wants to keep those that attend or may come forward anonymous for reasons of protecting them. But whenever these call-ins happen, everyone there probably is aware of the elephant in the room. They know the city can see its shadow. They want to make a change, coming deep from within a profound love for their city. They understand to make it prosperous, it has to address its security and its safety. To make Gary not something to be feared, but something to be embraced, strong and beautiful.
Well, that's something that I've strived to envision my entire career is driving up and down the streets and seeing some of the abandoned homes and more of the abandoned businesses and things. I would love to see the city of Gary come back to be a thriving city like it once was. The good majority of the city are good people. They go to work, they pay their rent, they're, you know, community people. There's a very small group of individuals, and we estimate that number to be anywhere between 300 and 500 individuals that are responsible for the violence inside the city. And really, if you take it down to the real violence, shootings, that number is even smaller. So our focus is to get those individuals off the street, rehabilitated, reformed, so that everyone else in the city, the rest of the population, can go about, just being good, positive community members.
We are just like everyone else. You know, we have the same hopes and the same aspirations as anyone, whether you live in Munster, whether you live in Crown Point, whether you live in Maryville, we have those exact same hopes and aspirations. So I believe that just as my children, your children, if you don't have any, or future children, that they feel just as safe in their community as any other community. So that is honestly my absolute hope, is that our children and our residents feel the exact same safety.
Byline is a production of the Times of Northwest Indiana. Episodes come out every 2 weeks and can be found at nwy.com/podcasts. Byline is also on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just type in NWI Byline in the search bar and we should pop up. If you've got a media player and want to download our episodes or listen on the go, Byline is available on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We just kindly ask that you rate us and leave a review because it actually really helps. And we'd like to hear from you, whether that's constructive comments, feedback, or suggestions for topics you'd like to hear more about. You can just drop an email to kale.wilk@nwi.com. Reporting for this week's episode came from Sarah Reese, Lauren Cross, and myself, Kale Wilk. We'd like to thank Joy Holiday and Doug Drummond for taking time to be interviewed for this episode. Credit for music production and mixing goes to the talented Dante Stewart. Finally, a big thanks goes to Summer Moore, the Times' digital and audience engagement editor, and Byline's creator. She's the lead on this team, and wherever it is that we go, I'm Kale Wilk, and from the Times of Northwest Indiana, thank you for listening. See you next time.
A group of Indiana high school students supported by a Valparaiso University organization returned recently from an 8-day trip to China. The trip took the students to see the Great Wall and Tiananmen Square in Beijing, the Yellow Mountains in Huangshan, a high school in Hangzhou, as well as a temple in Shanghai. Chaz Steves of the Washington Township School in Valparaiso says that while he and others may have had some preconceived ideas about what a communist country would be like, they weren't prepared for how accommodating the people in China would be.
See people walking down the streets, and they seem to act much more friendly and welcoming to everyone. Even street merchants aren't just selling you the item. They're welcoming you in, talking about some of the stuff, and then showing the stuff that they have to sell, whether it's in a museum or just the street stand itself.
Steves and the other students say they were surprised to find that despite the negative viewpoints about China that they've heard from politicians, high school students so many miles away from home have many of the same hopes and dreams as those in Indiana. And a student, Anna Denny, from the John Glenn High School in Walkerton, says it's evident that people in China take pride in their country.
Just the cleanliness standard in the cities. Honestly, most of the places we went, especially in Beijing, were a lot cleaner than American cities. And it was just nice to see that.
The students listed the smog, the traffic, and the crowded conditions as negatives of life in China. The trip was sponsored by Valparaiso University's Confucius Institute for students who study foreign languages in high school.
This series is part of Indiana Humanities Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. In this week's episode, we are headed to LaPorte, Indiana, a city known for its farming and agricultural innovations. LaPorte was home to the Rumley Company, which is commonly referred to as a revolutionary force in the agricultural industry in the late 1800s and early 1900s. The Rumley Company started as the venture of two brothers who had just immigrated from Germany. In 1853, Meinrad and John Rumley settled in LaPorte, Indiana, because it was situated along the railroad line from Chicago to New York. They thought they could have a successful blacksmithing business because of the location. But soon, they were drawn into the production of farm equipment. In 1854, they built the company's first thresher, a machine that removes the seeds of grain from the husk or stalk of a plant. The Rumley Company's threshers were incredibly successful, and they captured a big portion of the thresher market at the time. So, they expanded to bigger and newer forms of farm technology. The company made its first steam tractor in 1869. Steam was the beginning of experimentation in the tractor industry. Here's Dr. Douglas Hurt, head of the history department at Purdue University.
Many of the early tractors look like old steam engines because they're just iron dinosaurs. They might weigh 20,000 pounds, but they look like a steam traction or a gasoline tractor, sort of, except that it's a boiler and a steam engine. But they had to be pulled from place to place with horses. And so there was a seat on it, and people just moved those engines from one place to another by driving them. Most of the early steam traction engines could not pull a plow. They're simply mobile. They can move from one place to another, and they're used to power threshing machines with a big belt.
So steam tractors are nothing like the tractors we know today. They couldn't even move on their own, which to a lot of people might be the whole idea of a tractor. So innovation was needed to make these steam monsters into something more efficient. By this time, the Rumley Company was led by Edward Rumley, the grandson of Meinrad. He and an inventor, John Alstein Secor, invented one of the first internal combustion engines, and the very first one to run on kerosene. An internal combustion engine means that instead of having a heavy steam boiler on the outside of the machine, the engine is powered by fuel within the machine. This made all the difference. A gas-powered tractor had been invented already. But at the time, kerosene was a better choice for a lot of people.
Given the nature of the petroleum industry and what, you know, people like Rockefeller are turning out at the turn of the 20th century, kerosene was a cheaper fuel, usually, depending on where you are, I guess.
So in 1909, Rumley invented the first kerosene tractor and named it Kerosene Annie. Their line of kerosene tractors, called the Rumley Oil Poles, were hugely successful until the Great Depression. Even though diesel fuel would eventually prove to be the most efficient, these early tractor innovations were vital to the development of agriculture as we know it today. It's safe to say tractors with internal combustion engines changed farming forever. They made food cheaper and more abundant because it was cheaper to produce. And they revolutionized labor. Less farmers were needed to produce the same amount of food. And they also extended the working lives of farmers.
Farmers said, it extended their working life because it saved their legs. They could ride and they weren't following a plow. And they weren't walking across their fields a zillion times to plow or cultivate or something like that.
And though we don't use Rumley oil pull tractors in the modern era, Hoosier ingenuity and innovation contributed to farming as we know it today. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives by creating and facilitating programs that encourage Hoosiers to think, read, and talk. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, and I'm Sandra Burton.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, we have Indiana political analyst Brian Howie and the conversation about Hoosier politics, as well as the final days of the 2017 General Assembly session. We hope to join us for Regionally Speaking tomorrow.